For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way toward salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides, Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave. Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford. In the cave with me, your favorite troglodytes, Mr. Timothy O'Donnell, Mr. Mark Tuttle.
We're back in the cave again all together.
Not necessarily. 2020.
Not necessarily back in the saddle, but back in the cave.
So, correct.
2020, guys. Christmas season has, well, kind of pseudo-officially finished. We're going into the baptism of the Lord. So, you know, Christmas, all the decorations are getting put away. Mm-hmm. So we go through this period of ordinary time.
Yeah.
Which really isn't so ordinary, but it's ordinary time, and as in this week, next week, the week after. And then we come to this season called Lent, beginning Ash Wednesday. Ash Wednesday this year falls on February 26th, I believe.
Yep.
And it's a funny thing. You know, we've got Lent, but it's really a strange thing. Every year, Lent seems to fall at the exact same time as the Spring 40 Days for Life campaign.
Yes, there was something providential. Somebody way back when decided, okay, we're going to make Lent so that it corresponds with 40 Days for Life.
I think
life.
It was Aquinas. Perfect. It was Aquinas. Aquinas does everything.
That's right.
But, you know, interestingly, with 40 Days for Life falling on Lent, when 40 Days for Life was started, it was really a campaign leading up to the elections. So it was 40 days of prayer, fasting, and community activism around the abortion facilities to make life an issue leading up to the November elections. And then David B. Wright, who is the kind of one of the founders of the 40 Days for Life movement, I think they realized that a lot of Catholics, which were, you know, kind of the they're kind of the heart and soul of the pro-life movement to a good extent. They also wanted to do a 40 Days for Life during Lent to add that same fasting and period. They just seemed to go together. It was kind of like, you know, peanut butter and jelly. They just squished together very nicely. So then they started to inaugurate this 40 Days for Life in Lent. And, you know, David B. Wright, the founder of 40 Days for Life, was evangelical Protestant at the time. And, you know, he eventually, this year, one of the developments in the pro-life world this year is that he became Catholic.
Woohoo!
Yeah, like a lot.
He came home.
Yeah, a lot of people involved in the pro-life movement. And I find that a very interesting trend. There are a lot of people that get involved because of the sanctity of human life. They recognize the urgency of standing up for those that can't speak for themselves, particularly those in the womb. And as they get involved in that, as they pray, as they sacrifice, as they begin to fast, lo and behold, they start to see the rhythms of the church. They start to see the teachings of the church. They start to hear the prayers of the church, because there's so many Catholics involved in the pro-life movement, that there are a lot of converts. Even up in Wisconsin, there was a pastor that he wrote a book. He's a Protestant pastor. He wrote a book urging his congregation to stay away from the pro-life movement, not because they weren't pro-life, but because he thought it was a front for the Catholic Church to convert all these people to Catholicism. Yeah. So he didn't want them all converting to Catholicism. So he said, you know what?
Oh,
be pro-life, but don't be part of the whole pro-life movement.
Stay away from those kooky pro-life Catholics. Yeah.
So I think that adds, you know, you were going through the calendar of the year, Kent, as we're starting, and there's something unfortunately eerily appropriate about January being set aside as a month for life because of the Roe versus Wade decision that happened on January 22nd. January has become sort of a pro-life month. You know, Washington, D.C. gets taken over for almost a week now by pro-lifers.
Oh, yeah. There's it's in full swing right now.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, not only is it the March for Life, but there's a Students for Life conference, you know, that's scheduled there. So people go out a week ahead. Here in Indiana, we're going to have the Indiana March for Life on January 22nd.
Is this the third?
Third annual. Okay, yeah, third great. Annual Indiana yeah. March
Keeps
for
Life. Growing, too.
It does. It gets bigger each year. So we'll have, there'll be Mass at St. John the Evangelist and an ecumenical prayer service at the same time at the Convention Center at 10:30. And then after that, we'll gather along Georgia Street for the Indiana March for Life. And we'll proceed through the streets of Indianapolis.
Is that about noon, Adel? That
kicks off at noon. Yep, March kicks off at noon. And then finally, we will end with a rally there at the State House on the south steps of the State House. So we'll have some state senators that come out and speak with us. We'll have Bishop Doherty of the Lafayette Diocese.
Oh,
will speak
fantastic.
With us. We'll have there was some Protestant clergy that'll speak with us. So it'll be a great rally, and it's a great way to come out, and I think not only I guess get re-energized and ready for the year, but also to sort of recognize the importance and centrality of that sanctity of human life.
Well, that's a huge public witness, both it the March for Life in DC. One of the pain points for me around that, though, is what are there? On the low end, there's 200,000 people, maybe. At the high end, there's 400,000-500,000 people. And we get maybe on one major media outlet, we get maybe 30 seconds of coverage.
Right.
And it's by far, and this is 47 years later into the movement, it's by far the largest ongoing, and it dwarfs almost any other kind of even one-off rally that you see in our state capitol. That really still gets under my skin.
And the only time we get any kind of coverage on that is when there's confrontation.
Oh, yes, Covington right. Catholic.
No confrontation, no coverage.
Right. And once again, it wasn't the crowd that was covered with all the media coverage. It was sort of the fact that there was this confrontation between a high school student and a bunch of rabble-rousing protesters.
Correct. Who agitating for trouble.
Exactly. Yep. So, the March for Life, by and large, goes ignored by the media, but the country notices. Mm-hmm. And here in Indianapolis, the city notices. They see the presence. They know that the people are there. And it's so important that we have this day. The really important part is that we're petitioning the Supreme Court to readdress the question of Roe versus Wade.
Right.
And either allow the states to vote on it, or better yet, recognize the personhood of the unborn, in which case 14th Amendment protection comes into play, and the laws across the land should protect these innocent children. So it's that petition that's really important. But it's also, I think, fitting that we start the year off in January with this large movement to recognize the sanctity of human life, because when you do that, you're setting your calendar up to a certain extent to where you've got this recognition of the sanctity of human life. Mm-hmm. And then after that, we move into Lent and we recognize the fallen nature of humanity and how much we've defaced it. And it kind of gives a reason why, to a certain extent, that we're dealing with abortion in our culture because of our sinfulness and because of that, honestly, desire for us to be like God. That desire that's there because of concupiscence within the heart of everybody that says, I want to make the rules. I want to decide what's right and wrong. I want to decide what's good and evil. And more importantly, I want to decide who is good and who is not good. And I want to decide that this person has value and this person does not. And that's really why we're there. So it's very fitting that we start the year with this large stand for the sanctity of human life.
Yeah, because everything, all our other rights and duties and responsibilities, they all rest upon that fundamental right to life. Because if you're not alive, if you're not here, then there's no need for any other rights.
And not only that, but I think it's not only recognizing those rights within ourselves, but recognizing, right after the fall in the Genesis account, what do you have? You have Cain and Abel.
Right.
And so it's recognizing that the answer to that question, are you your brother's keeper, is yes.
Yeah,
you're
absolutely.
You're responsible for protecting that right to life. You're responsible for protecting the other's rights. And so it all falls from that recognition that we have that intrinsic value because we're made in the image and likeness of God. And because of that, we have to cherish that. We have to protect it. We have to stand up and we have to be witnesses for it when it is trashed, violated, discarded, especially on a society-wide level like we've got it now.
Yeah, I mean, the country's awash in abortion. You know, there's definitely been progress made to better the situation. But even if, I mean, even if there's what, maybe 900,000 abortions still each year, something along that nature. And then even keeping track of it now with like Plan B, it's harder to know exactly the demise of the unborn, how many are being killed. And I will say, though, I am a little optimistic about the makeup of the Supreme Court, because it looks like we do have probably more like-minded justices that, depending on and navigating the court system and cases and things like that, are always very difficult to do and much less predict. But it does seem like under the, I mean, in my estimation, the current administration is by far the most pro-life administration we've ever had in this country. And it's not just what's happening in the Supreme Court, but there's lots and lots of reason to be optimistic about many other appointments.
Yeah, particularly judicial appointments. Yes. And I would say the more important level is that level below the Supreme Court. You know, there was a case that came through on an ultrasound law in Kentucky. So there was a law passed in Kentucky that was going to require that women be shown an ultrasound before an abortion. And, you know, this is crucial, because women, by and large, when they see an ultrasound and they recognize that this is a human person that I will be destroying, it's not just some
baby.
It's not a magic, you know, it's not some magic procedure to where I can just,
or just an abstract idea with some sort of euphemistic term like your pregnancy. We're going to terminate your pregnancy. Well, every pregnancy terminates. Most pregnancies terminate with what? Birth.
Yeah. So when women do see the ultrasound, they're much more likely to choose life. And so, you know, this is an important law for saving lives simply through education. Well, the courts, it was challenged in the courts, like almost every pro-life law, it gets challenged. And the lower courts initially upheld it and said, no, you know, Kentucky has a right to do this. Unlike, we passed a similar law here in Indiana, where the courts in Indiana rejected it. And so I think this is where the lower courts come into play, because by the time it got through the appeals process and up to the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court just simply refused to hear the case.
Right.
And by refusing to hear the case in the Kentucky situation, that allowed that law to stay in place. So now they're allowed to have that law. Here in Indiana, when we had a similar law that went through the courts, because it was a negative judgment against it, which, you know, unfortunately, we've got an uphill battle in Indiana, unlike a lot of other states. I think we've got one of the track record here in Indiana as far as pro-life legislation being upheld or rejected by the courts is not good. Because it was a negative ruling when the Supreme Court heard it, and they once again said, well, we're really not going to hear that case, that left that ruling in place. So the lower courts having judges that respect the sanctity of human life from conception to natural death at the lower level in a lot of ways is almost more important than it is at the Supreme Court. And what's happened recently with judicial appointments is the courts across the nation have flip-flopped, you know, and you know, there are charts and things that show the number of those judges that you can kind of guess probably have more sympathy for the abortionists and the abortion industry, and those judges that recognize the sanctity of human life and the importance of protecting that. And it's seesawed. So we now have more justices that respect life than don't.
Yeah, we need to take a break. We'll be back with more of The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy right after this.
At Catholic Radio, we love to hear from you. Call us anytime. Just recently, we found this message on our voicemail.
I'm a non-Catholic that listens to your Catholic radio station, and I just wanted to thank you guys. I listen to Catholic Answers and Al Cresta sometimes, and I think her name's Teresa Tommy. I listen to her and another show or two. I appreciate it.
Call us at 317-870-8400 and let us know what you're thinking.
I just called to say, even though I'm not a Catholic, I listen to your station.
Welcome back to The Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford. In the cave with me, Mr. Mark Tuttle, Mr. Timothy O'Donnell. Gentlemen, we've been talking about the value of life. And one of the challenges that we have today is the fact that in many ways, the value of life is dependent on your religious beliefs, on your faith and those types of things. And many years ago, prayer was taken out of the schools. So there's no God in schools. So overall, as a society for now almost two generations, if you're going to learn anything about faith or anything about God, it had to be at home. It had to be through your family. And now we're looking at two generations that, you know, haven't been exposed to that, haven't been exposed to any thought that we were made by a creator, that there even is a creator. How do we reach these people who don't have a concept of the sacred and tell them that life is sacred?
That's a great question. So maybe a way to begin to answer that is maybe we can kind of divide that into two camps. There's sort of a theological camp and ways in which we could try to show them that there are good, sound theological reasons to hold to the position that life is sacred. But they may not be very effective because they may not believe in or be open to or be disposed to theological arguments or propositions. So we would maybe pivot to camp number two, which is philosophy, which is kind of what we do here in the Catholic Cave.
It's kind of
an
like
appeal to reason, common sense, good arguments, evidence, proofs that you don't need an appeal to the divine, let's say, in order to make the case that human beings are, I like to use the term, intrinsically valuable.
Yeah, it's kind of like those gangster movies where you've got the guy that he's been captured by the bad guys and he's tied up to the chair. Mm-hmm. And the guy walks in and he starts to roll up his sleeves and he says, okay, we can do this the easy way or we can do this the hard way. And in a lot of ways, theology and philosophy play off each other that way.
Yep,
so,
you
know, as St. Thomas Aquinas says, you know, one of the reasons we need divine revelation is because it's the easy way. You know, we get to the same point, I think, whether we take a philosophical route of looking at these things through natural philosophy, we can go a long, long way towards recognizing the existence of a creator, the goodness of his creation, you know, understanding because of that there is intrinsic value, sacredness even within that. But that takes a long time and a lot of study and a lot of argumentation to get there. And B, because our reason is fallible, it's prone to error. We can make mistakes along the way and get off track and make wrong conclusions and draw up, you know, sort of erroneous opinions. Where by having revelation and theology, it's a much shorter route. It's much easier. And we can come to the same understandings by faith, simply by recognizing that these things have been revealed to us by a good God that loves us and is revealing all of this to us for our betterment. So you get the easy way and the hard way. And, you know, I think we should probably talk a little bit about both.
Good point. Let's start with maybe I'll take the hard way first. If the philosophical way might be a little bit harder. But I think here's some things I might point out to someone or share with someone who, say, is at least a practical atheist, someone who's not particularly open to or practicing any sort of theological framework in their lives. So I might point out a few things that are special or unique about the human person that points to the human person being intrinsically valuable. One case I might make is to point out that human beings are really engaged in four basic things, and that would be human beings can make, human beings can do, human beings can create, and human beings can love. And so you put all that together in a way that other creatures don't. And so that gives us a kind of that should be able to recognize that there's a kind of special status. There's something special about human persons because we can make, we can do, we can create, and we can love in ways that other creature far differently, putting us in a completely different category than all other creatures. And you don't have to appeal to the divine to see that we can do that.
Right. And I think that specialness, you know, the idea that humanity is exceptional above and beyond the other animals and other life on the planet. That's really kind of the bar that you're trying to get over. Mm-hmm. And part of that is because we recognize that there's value and importance and dignity to all life to a good extent. I mean, it's very rare that you're going to find somebody that thinks it's okay to be cruel, to use, to abuse, to do whatever we want with anything and everything out there. I mean, most people recognize that, you know, being mean to puppies is a bad thing. You know,
I like to say torturing toddlers for fun.
Yeah,
people can see immediately right. That there's something
exactly
universally wrong about that.
And when it comes to puppies and sheep and lambs and cute creatures, people have a natural affinity to recognize that. So the bar, when you're talking about some sort of sacredness to human life, is to say, look, we are exceptional in a way that puts us above and beyond puppies and sheep and pigs and cows and right. All these other creatures that we all recognize we need to be nice to.
But then again, we run into the Darwinists who say, mm-hmm. you know, we are nothing more than, you know, advanced apes. And, you know, in a lot of ways, many of the animal rights movements out there, mm-hmm. I'm not sure whether they're raising animals to the levels of humans or lowering humans to the level of animals.
Right. And, you know, I think one of the philosophical concepts that's lost in this that needs to get reintroduced, and it's hard to do it because it's somewhat antiquated, is recognizing that good old scholastic principle of potentiality and getting that out there, that the human being contains in himself these abilities, these potentials that go so far beyond the potentials of other creatures. Mm-hmm. And mainly through our intellect and our reason and our will. We really literally have the ability to create a society that allows us to go to the far reaches of the universe. And our minds are situated to allow us to potentially go even farther than that. I mean, human beings can think infinity, and the human will can love infinitely to a great extent. Not to say we're God, but we are made in the image of God. Oh, I brought the theology shortcut in there, but you know, philosophically, you can kind of get to that same understanding that our wills are expansive enough that we can approach infinite loving and infinite compassion and infinite knowledge. And because of that, that puts us far beyond what we know of any of the other creatures.
Yeah. I might put it this way in an effort to make maybe a similar same point, going back to like Plato's cave where we borrowed the name, where that was our inspiration for the Catholic cave. What does Plato talk about in the allegory of the cave? He talks about that the human person, our intellect, is capable of reaching to what universal concepts. So when you have universal concepts, that to me begins to speak to this sort of ideas without sort of conventional material restrictions on them. So when we think about a universal concept like justice, or we can go into things like mathematics, where we actually make use of the term in a very real sense of the term infinity, right? We can use infinity in equations, for example. Numbers themselves have a kind of eternal quality to them, right? 2 + 2 = 4, once you know what those all those terms mean, have a timeless kind of quality to them. In other words, 2 + 2 = 4 has always been true. It's true now, and it always will be true going forward. So they have a kind of an eternal or timeless immaterial quality to it. So we can point to things like universal concepts. Another thing that along related to that comes to my mind is human beings, just from a very kind of practical point, human beings are the only creatures that legislate. In other words, we come up with laws external to our physical beings that govern us. There's no other creature that does that or is capable of doing it. In other words, it's not like the dolphins are going to get there someday. They're never going to get there because they lack that potential. It's never going to develop in them because it doesn't exist. So those are some ways in which we can think about and linguistics would be a whole nother one. And that immediately people kind of will bring up, well, but apes can respond to, or gorillas can respond to certain things or certain words, like vocabulary, like 200 words. Well, yeah, but that's more like a correlation between sounds and images and learned behavior, which is very different. Here's what gorillas can't do, if that linguistic question comes. No creature other than human beings are capable of language, in that we have grammar, we have rhetoric, and we actually can put sentences together that make use of something that we all take for granted, like pronouns. Like, you cannot teach another animal he or she and expect them to know what it means. Or you can't expect them to understand the universal concept of ball, what a ball is. You can show them and train them to respond to a golf ball of a certain kind. You can teach them to respond to a basketball of a certain kind, or a volleyball of a certain kind. But you can't teach them ball, because ball is a universal kind. They're just not they're not capable of it. And again, not because they haven't, that they're going to eventually get there. They can't get there because they don't have it.
Right. And the point when you're looking at sacredness and the idea that there's something about human life that needs to be respected so that we do not destroy it, alter it, limit it, and curtail its capacities, that comes because there's a certain threshold of our reason that I think even if these other animals could surpass it, and I think by all evidence, you're quite right, Tim, by all evidence, there's no other creatures we know of that could, but there's an ability of the human intellect to go beyond and outside of our bodies. And,
right.
You know,
there's an immaterial,
right. An immaterial quality to our thought and to our will that
correct,
allows us. And if another animal,
love would be a great example,
right? If another animal had that capability, then the question would become, are they also then not sacred as well? It's not that if they reach it, then suddenly human life is not sacred. It's that there's a threshold there, that when you have this quality about your intellect to where it's expansive to the point that you recognize that it's immaterial and to a certain extent infinite, then human life becomes sacred.
And we're going to take another break here. You're listening to The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy. We'll be right back.
Most of us like to keep up on what's going on in the world and try to catch a little news each day. Did you know that you can catch the very latest Catholic news right on our website? We have news from Rome, from around the world, and here at home, updated every day, so you always know what's going on from a Catholic perspective. Check it out. Go to CatholicRadioIndy.org and look for the Catholic news headlines. There's always something new at CatholicRadioIndy.org.
And welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle, here with Timothy O'Donnell.
Correct.
Say, you've been away so long, we can't even say your name right.
I know. So, my poor Irish ancestors rolling over in their graves.
So Timothy O'Donnell and Kent Blanford, we are here in the cave. And as we do so often here on the cave, we are trying to get below the surface level of the discussion of the time, the discussion du jour. And this is January. This is pro-life month to a great extent because of the Roe versus Wade Supreme Court decision. And so we're talking about sanctity of human life. We're talking about what is it that makes human life intrinsically valuable or intrinsically sacred. Mm-hmm. And I really think there's a secular argument for sacredness. I don't think mm-hmm. sacredness is necessarily exclusively a religious term. So I think we can use it in a non-religious philosophical sense of something that has infinite value in and of itself that becomes inviolate. And definitely a human, the human intellect, the ability for human reason, the potentialities of the human brain, not just individually, but collectively. I think that definitely rises to that level of sacred.
I think we should talk about building off that point and see how that applies to, we focus a lot of on the unborn so far, but what would you say about, because we definitely have a lot of threats now through end of life issues, where people have chronic debilitating diseases, conditions, pain, loss of functionality. What would you say? I mean, is that special dignity or sacredness you're talking about, Mark, does that change over time? Like, can I lose some of it? Can I become less special?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, is your worth and dignity, is that based on what you are able to do, or is it based on who you are? And, you know, I think when we look at it from a theological, once again, we can use that little shortcut. You know, we've got the ability to kind of look over here at divine revelation and see what's been revealed through the church and through sacred scripture and through sacred tradition. So we can take that little shortcut and look over here and say, okay, we're all made in the image and likeness of God. So it really is who we are and not what we can do. But let's now backtrack that and look at that philosophically a little bit and kind of maybe try to take that. You know, if your dignity is based on what you can do, then what is ultimately important is not the potentiality of your reason, as we were just talking about. Your sense of sacredness comes from that potential of the human mind, the will, in religious sense, you know, your soul, that ability to go beyond yourself, to the farthest reaches of the universe. I think it was Aristotle, I may be getting the wrong philosopher here, I think it was Aristotle that said the human mind is the universe in microcosm. In other words, all of us contain the entirety of the universe within our brains because we're able to think it. If it's what we can do with that ultimately gives us dignity, then that's short-circuiting that. You know, that's putting that, the what we actually do is something above and beyond and more important than that infinite expanse of will and infinite expanse of intellect that we were just talking about. And to a certain extent, that's logically inconsistent. You know, what you can potentially do is always going to be greater than what you actually do, just by logic. And so that potentiality has greater dignity and importance than that actuality.
I also think the there's an argument to be made, or at least a position maybe worth pointing out to someone to say, hey, look, here I'll borrow from Scott Klusendorf with his SLED argument, where SLED's an acronym, and S stands for size. In other words, I think we would generally find it morally repugnant or morally unacceptable to say, to use a person's size as a category for determining their worth or dignity. In other words, are taller people intrinsically better than or more valuable or more dignified? I myself am tall, so I have a little skin in this game than Kent, who's a little bit, who's a man of classic proportions, yeah, shall we say?
Yeah, he is.
You know, is my height, is our height difference make one or the other more valuable? And I would say, what do you say, Kent?
I say no.
Yeah, you say
absolutely no.
Yeah, and that's not how we think about it, right? And then, so our size or girth or weight, those aren't things, that sort of material. Or, you know, level of development, you know, are 10-year-olds intrinsically more valuable than 9-year-olds? Something like that. 30-year-olds more valuable from a worth standpoint than say, 10-year-olds. Now, one might go, well, And this will introduce that concept of utilitarianism. One might say, well, yeah, 30-year-olds generally are more useful than 10-year-olds because 30-year-olds have typically have acquired certain amount of knowledge and understanding and education, but physical abilities and skills and learned behaviors that 30-year-olds are able to, say, accomplish or do more than, say, 10-year-olds. So someone might bring up that utilitarian argument and say, well, yeah, people, but then that's something then later, though, you'd have to argue that as you, if you live into ripe old age, your usefulness declines. And this is the argument for legalized euthanasia, assisted suicide, is that people become less value or we ought to be able to discard them, or they ought to be able to end their own lives when their usefulness has reached a certain low level or down to zero, let's say.
Right. And once again, that falls into that question of, you know, is the importance and worth of a human being based on what it can do, or is it based upon what it is? And, you know, if you say it's based upon what it can do, then you wind up with a whole bunch of egalitarian questions of, you know, okay, so therefore the more productive people, the people that are able to produce more and do more, they are worth more. And the dignity of somebody that is not able to produce as much for a wide variety of reasons. I mean, poverty mm-hmm. would be a huge part of that. Somebody that has less resources at their disposal can naturally do less. So, you know, then you get a huge society-wide egalitarian problem, which I think brings in another, when you're talking about this philosophically, another point in this is when we talk about the worth and dignity of human beings, we tend to talk about it on an individualistic level. Mm-hmm. You know, we're talking about the worth and dignity of this person, and does this individual have worth and dignity? The fact of the matter is, though, we are born into community. We live in community, and none of us exist outside of a community. You know, even the most primitive tribes that we find still on Earth today, or go back and look at the archaeological records, mm-hmm. they lived in community of mm-hmm. some variety. And so your worth and dignity is very much as a part of that community. And so the idea of euthanasia, the idea of getting rid of those whom we find no longer useful, it diminishes the community because it's not respecting the importance of each and every individual, regardless of what they do. So there's a diminishment of humanity in general that goes on when you diminish the value of the individuals that are part of it. And I think that's a really important philosophical point to bring about, is we're not just talking about individuals. We're talking about what kind of community we're creating by allowing these certain behaviors, and certainly to get rid of people we find to be less able, less burdensome, etc. Mm-hmm. That diminishes the value and potential and abilities of the whole community.
Yeah, it brings up too, to backtrack just a little bit. I want to plug a documentary program that was put together. It was really outstanding by PBS on eugenics, on the eugenics movement. You can actually buy the DVDs through Amazon and probably other locations too, or maybe stream it off PBS website. And what I like, the reason why I'm bringing up eugenics is was that impulse to, I would say, capitalize on Darwinian evolutionary theory in order to accelerate evolution for the survival of the fittest. And large parts, especially various governments and academia, were swept up in that ideological movement that produced horrific consequences. It emerged with things like, and it was very prevalent in the United States too, and in the state of Indiana, for example, but it would point to things like, if what drives human beings, what they can do then, or if our understanding the worth of human, what we can do, a utilitarian view, then you would want to maximize the number. You'd want to have programs in place that maximize the number of people in society that are useful and can contribute and produce, and you want to minimize or eliminate those who are burdensome. And I'll say, you know, and a lot of that started in the 20th century. And I would say there's echoes of that still, even if it's not explicitly, people don't explicitly identify as eugenics, but I would say the intellectual thrust is to be found and comes from the eugenics movement of the 20th century. And the two places it's still with us, one in a very sharp, tragic example, is the elimination of children with Down syndrome. That when we know Iceland, for example, has completely eliminated children with Down syndrome through abortion. So prenatal testing to identify children that may have Down syndrome, and then aborting them all without exception, has resulted in Iceland not having any Down syndrome children. And then in the United States, the figures I've seen are 90%+. And so that's a way of ridding ourselves of those who we know if born will be for as long as they live will require special needs and they have special needs and will require special resources, attention, and most of all, love. And so we're not up to that challenge, it would seem, as a society. The other place that you see it, again, I'll go back to, this is where, again, euthanasia comes in. Euthanasia comes in and says, hey, look, there's a certain reality here that people don't talk about that much, and that's the economics of old age. Most people, most of us, are going to, the vast majority of us, are going to use the and run up the highest healthcare costs the last 2 years of our lives. Why is that? Well, because in your last couple, that's when you become frail, needy. You're going to need more care, and healthcare is very expensive. So anything you can do to sort of shorten that 24-month window, like by killing the patient, especially with or without their consent, is going to save the society a lot of money.
Right. And the reason for that is because whenever you have a belief system like eugenics, or really any type of utilitarian view of humanity, you're saying there are goods and goals that go beyond the dignity of the human person. So you're saying, well, what's more important than the dignity of the human person? A certain standard of living. Or what's more important than the dignity of the human person? A certain advancement of society mm-hmm. along in a certain direction, or a certain standard of comfort, or a certain standard of peace and equanimity among a culture. And so by saying that those are more important than the dignity of an individual human person, you're opening yourself up to all sorts of tragic misuses and treatments and sterilization, abortion, mm-hmm. killing. You're opening yourself up to a whole world of ways that that value and intrinsic dignity of the human person is violated.
We need to take a break. We'll be right back with more of the Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy right after this.
You know us as Catholic Radio Indy, but we're so much more than just radio. We're a website, CatholicRadioIndy.org, with access to great Catholic resources, including podcasts of all our local programming, podcasts that have been downloaded from all 50 states and over 40 countries on 6 continents. Yes, we are Catholic Radio Indy, but thanks to your support, we're taking the gospel of Christ to the ends of the earth. Catholic Radio Indy and CatholicRadioIndy.org.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm still Timothy O'Donnell. So, Mark, we've been talking about the dignity of the human person. We're in the last segment of our program today. And let's turn our attention a little bit to duties and obligations and responsibilities. Because we spend a lot of time in our society and our current conversations around rights. I have a right to this, I have a right to that, I have a right to the other thing. We talk about right to life, obviously. But let's talk about the other side of that coin, which is rights exist because duties, there's corresponding duties as well. So let's talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's part of the fallen nature of man. Once again, we're taking that shortcut and looking at theology a little bit to fill in some of the gaps. But
I'm with Chesterton. All you have to do is look around and you
exactly.
can see humanity's fallen.
Right.
I mean, it is a disaster out there if you look around the globe, generally, in my estimation.
But yeah, because we're fallen, we're always going to have our rights threatened by other people. Other people who are more powerful than us. Other people
tyrannical.
Other people that
vicious.
Are envious. They want to take away what we have. They want to destroy
malicious.
Us because
yeah.
of what we have. Any number of things that you can look at and say, look, humanity is by nature wicked.
well, yeah. that's kind of the concupiscence.
Kind of the concupiscence, but
yeah,
I think
the original sin.
But you know what? It's not just religious people that have come to that conclusion. You've got secular philosophers that have looked and said, you know what? Without society, without laws, without rules, without us watching out for one another, life would be short, nasty, and brutish. You know, need those.
One of my favorite quotes.
Yeah, we need.
Yeah.
It would be much more so, I guess. Okay. We can say that.
Yeah.
But so given that, it is up to us, especially in a democratic society where we live, to make sure that these rights for our neighbors are upheld and protected.
Right. So it's not enough, right? I think our position would be it's not enough to engage in wishful thinking, but we actually have to turn our principled position of the dignity and special value, sacredness of human life into action. And there's a variety of different ways we can turn that into action. But we do need to actively defend human life from unjust violence.
Exactly. And that's what January and January 22nd is all about. It's about those people that recognize the intrinsic value of human life, the sacredness of human life, standing up in the face of laws that are allowing others to violate that, that are allowing other people without, you know, recourse, without the ability of bringing in our civil society to protect life. That's been stripped away from us by the Supreme Court decision Roe versus Wade. And so it's a chance for us to stand up and say this is not right, and to ask and demand not only the Supreme Court, but our other officials to do something to give us back the ability to defend each and every human life from conception to natural death.
So tell us more about, I know we covered this early in the show, but if people just are tuning in. So January 22nd,
right?
We've got, there's really kind of two different opportunities. There's the National March for Life and the local March for Life.
Right. Now, the National March for Life will be Friday, January 24th. So you have a bunch of people heading out to Washington, D.C. And that whole week is actually full of activities and things.
Events, speakers.
And then it continues on even after the 24th. But the March, the National March for Life, there'll be 400, 300, 500,000 people marching in the streets of Washington. That will be January 24th. Here in Indiana, we're going to have our own local Indiana March for Life in downtown Indianapolis.
Third annual.
And that will start at noon. We'll gather along Georgia Street, and we'll march to the Soldier and Sailors Monument, and then to the State House, where we'll have a rally. We'll hear from religious officials. We'll hear from political officials, all in that effort to raise concern for those who right now are not protected by law in Indiana or across the nation because of the Roe versus Wade Supreme Court decision that happened on January 22nd in 1973. And before that march, though, we'll also have a couple of religious services. We'll have a Catholic Mass at St. John the Evangelist at 10:30. That'll be with Archbishop Thompson and Bishop Doherty.
Ooh, and then man, fantastic.
We'll also have an ecumenical memorial service where we will be memorializing all of the children that have died and the women that have died because of supposedly safe legal abortion. And in addition, we're going to have a special focus on those 2,400 children whose remains were found in the property of the late abortionist Ulrich Klopfer in Illinois. He was an abortionist that performed abortions.
What an evil, sick man he was.
Yeah, he collected the babies after he had...
Like trophies.
Well, yeah, I don't know if they were for trophies. I don't know if he was collecting them for future experimental use.
Nobody were in his car, for heaven's sake.
Yeah, some of them were in his car. Some of them were
like
in the garage.
123 of them or something.
Yeah,
there were something really demented.
Yeah, there were 2,411 bodies altogether that were collected. So that memorial service will be focusing on those babies, but it'll also be a memorial service for all the babies that have perished through abortion since January 22nd, 1973.
That makes it very real, though. You know, this is, you know, a lot of times we talk about pro-life, pro-choice, and very and what can be sometimes, you know, kind of abstract. You know, these are sort of abstractions, blah, blah, blah. But I'll tell you what, you watch a movie like Unplanned, the story of Abby Johnson's life, and you will see exactly one very, very realistic portrayal of the heinous crime that abortion is.
Yeah, and you know, there's a portrayal in there where there's a lot of blood. There's a lot of that, and it's interesting when you contrast watching either that scene or other footage of abortions as they take place. You have a visceral response that is much different than if you're watching knee surgery. Or if you're watching heart surgery. Actually, watching open heart surgery is fascinating. You know, it's interesting to see how they're healing and bringing this heart back, you know, kind of back to life and putting it back together. That's all very fascinating. When it involves the destruction of a human being, there's an instinctual revulsion that I mean, you have to be incredibly calloused, I think, not to feel that.
That touches on another quick point to make philosophically, which is there's a real imminent danger that that abortion has brought about in this, besides the obvious, and that is that it has turned medical doctors into killers. And then we see that again, and we see it being replicated and magnified in what euthanasia, where again, you have highly talented, highly trained people who no longer simply pursue the intrinsic goods of health and healthcare, but have incorporated a vein of murder and killing as part of their profession. And you know, talk about a betrayal of the Hippocratic Oath, which is a pagan oath, by the way. It is really, really dangerous from an ideological standpoint of us turning healthcare into the business of industrialized killing.
Right. And you know, it's part of a transformation. It actually goes beyond just the killing involved in it, too. You know, medicine started as the healing arts. It was an right. art of restoring health to an individual and bringing a human body back to its proper function and proper proper health. And over, you know, in the 20th century, through several movements, that changed. And now it became the art of manipulating the human body without regard for health. You know, obviously, health is still somewhat of a goal, but there's other goals as well. So not only is it manipulating the human body to bring about health, but it's manipulating the human body to control the number of children. It's manipulating the human body to better society.
Manufacturing children,
correct. It's manipulating the human body to be able to provide goods like, you know,
organ transplants. That's another one.
Exactly.
There's all kind of gruesome, ghastly things emerging with organ transplantation now.
And you're very right. I think abortion.
You wake up somewhere and your kidney's gone.
Yeah, I think the acceptance of abortion. The acceptance.
That's a bad night, by the way.
Yeah, the acceptance of abortion was very much a Pandora's box. You know, I think for medicine, when it was legalized and the medical profession accepted abortion as part of medical practice, that was a Pandora's box that opened up this whole other world of allowing the manipulation of the human body and the science of physiology and what we know about the human body to be used for all sorts of other things other than restoring health.
Yeah. Tell us, Mark, how we're can find out more information about the Local March for Life.
Right. So Local March for Life, you can go to probably the best places on social media. So going to Facebook, either to Right to Life's Facebook page, which is Right to Life of Indianapolis, or you can go to the Office of Human Life and Dignity through the Archdiocese and find information there as well. And you can either go to their Facebook page and event, or you can also find them online at archindy.org and then make your way to the Office of Human Life and Dignity. You can also go to www.rtlindy.org. So that's the webpage of Right to Life of Indianapolis. And there'll be information there about the march, the memorial service, the mass, all of it.
Yeah, even if you can't attend, you can support it. You know, we need, and there's a lot of ways to support it too. We need volunteers, financial donations are always welcome, prayers, most especially. But the public witness is key. There's just a few times a year that we can really bring substantial public witness to these issues. If for some reason you can't make the, tell everyone to go to March for Life. But if you can't make it, or if you do make it and want to continue, just a preview that the spring campaign, 40 Days for Life, will be here before you know it. Starts on Ash Wednesday, which is February 26th. We'll run through April 5th, which is Palm Sunday. And as is our tradition, that Sunday before Ash Wednesday, which if I do my math right, is the 23rd? I think so. We'll be at St. Luke's Catholic Church from 2 to 3 p.m. with a kickoff event and a speaker, and then we'll conclude. But more to come on 40 Days for Life. Let's focus on the anniversary of Roe v. Wade, bringing a prayerful, peaceful, joyful presence about the sanctity of life, the good that God has bestowed on us as his sons and daughters, and in defense of the most vulnerable and weak among us.
And that is all the time we have for the Catholic Cave for today. For Mark Tuttle, for Timothy O'Donnell, I'm Kent Blanford. Until next time, be holy.
The Catholic Cave is a production of Catholic Radio Indy. Replays of this program are available in podcast form at catholicradioindy.org. Comments about this program can be addressed to kent@catholicradioindy.org or by calling 317-870-8400.
Did you miss something in this show or just want to hear it again? Podcasts of this and all our other great local programs are available 24/7 at catholicradioindy.org.